Thanks, Javon. Please pray with me, friends. Father in the heavens, you know what's at stake. You know what's important. You know all the issues. We do not know from season to season what is important for our age and our time unless you show it. I ask, Father, that you let the right things I have here, all those proper and good things, let those have the urgency in the hearts and minds of the hearers as you ordain. And let everything that is unimportant fall to the ground. We beg you to continue speaking to us and leading us and convicting us of sin and redirecting our efforts. We submit ourselves to you in the name and through the blood of Yahshua of Nazareth, the resurrected Messiah. Amen. Hallelujah. Brothers and sisters, I'm Brother Michael Bannock from Fulton, Missouri. May every blessing of Yahshua be yours eternally. The title of my remarks today is Their Names Are Blotted Out. Well, I'm going to use this occasion. Last time I prepared notes that I thought would only take up 45 minutes, I wound up going 6 minutes over the allotted time. But this time I really think it's going to be shorter than normal. I think this time it'll go fast. So I'm going to carve out a few minutes to get some nice things off my chest. I remember meeting Elder Don Mansager and his wife Mildred many years ago, and by some kind of instinct, maybe I was momentarily anointed. I thanked Sister Mildred profusely for what she had endured as the leading minister's wife, and I sure her eyes got moist. And as time went by and I started paying attention, I noticed this was a theme across the board. There are men who are in official ministry. There are men who are in unofficial ministry. They're working feverishly in the background. Nobody laid hands on them, but they're part of the team anyway. And time after time, I see that while these men are parading around on the center stage and you see all their actions, the wives are sacrificing too. The wives are sacrificing in big ways. Maybe you haven't noticed, but I've noticed. It never fails. And this year was particularly stressful for the local members because you had the men in leadership, you had the wives doing leadership type work, you know, taking care of all kinds of things, and you have the wives sacrificing too. So on behalf of the whole assembly, I thank you local women for all you've given. Some of you have really put your fingers on the anvil for this one. And I'm so grateful for all you've done for us. I see the sacrifice. Well, think about it. If I noticed, if a dumbbell like me can notice, surely the angels see it. Yahweh sees it. Okay? We're going to talk about names being blotted out. And I will tie it into things that are important. Eternal things, worship type things. This is not just some intellectual adventure. There are high matters of extreme importance derived from the study we're going to do today. We'll cover the bitter consequences of having a name blotted out. We're going to look at a handful of Bible people whose names are blotted out. We'll look at some spiritual aspects of those cases and what are the implications for worship. There are so many verses speaking to the matter of removing a name that one can only conclude that this is serious stuff. It's one of those things in the Bible that's all over the place, and I don't suppose people too often stop and think about it. So this is my chance. There seems to be two kinds of blotting out. Maybe there's more, but there's two that I notice. One is to blot out somebody's name from the earth, where you just wipe out all memory of them from the earth. Just let me tap the brake. One of the names we'll be looking at is the name of Amalek. And I just sometimes I'll look at Wikipedia because they might have a reference in there that I overlooked. But Wikipedia is often thrown together by faithless people who don't give a rip about the Bible. But one of those, if you look on the wiki page for Amalek or the Amalekites, you'll find that no historical reference can be found of them. I thought, well, isn't that funny? That's what Yahweh says. He's going to blot out the name of the Amalekites. I happen to agree with Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky, who in the 1950s said that the Amalekites look like a people known elsewhere in history as the Amu. Amu, A-M-U, an incredibly vicious bunch. They were way off the rails. Oh. And what happened is, as the Israelites were leaving Egypt, the Amu went into Egypt and took over for a while. And they gave trouble to our people. Well, blotting out a name from the earth is one thing, where someone's simply forgotten. A person or a group of people are simply forgotten. And then the other type is to have one's name blotted out from the book of life. We'll be talking about both of them, both cases. But put it this way, both kinds of cases will be emerging in the course of this review. Now, there's an awful lot of verses that talk about names being blotted out or forgotten or removed. I'm not going to read off this web link here. Instead, if you just do a general search on the internet for the following phrase, 23 Bible verses about names blotted out, you'll find this list. But there are many more beyond this. I think they picked 23 verses because it comes from Psalm 23. They want you to remember that number for some reason, because it's way more than 23. But I'll just read four of them and explain the context to you. In Deuteronomy 25:6, it says, "It shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel." Okay, what's this about? It's sometimes called a Levirate marriage. I don't think it has anything to do with Levi, but it's just called a Levirate marriage. And this is where some guy's married, he dies, and so his brother must take that woman as his own and raise up a child, and that first child that comes out must be given the name of his father in terms of carrying on the family name. And this was real serious business to keep your family name going. In Joshua 7:9, it reads as follows, "For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it, and they will surround us and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name?" Okay, this is Joshua praying. And he's saying, look, we're going to be wiped out, and nobody's going to remember us. Now, this is a terrifying possibility. In Psalm 109, verse 13, someone is praying against his enemies, and he says, "Let his posterity be cut off in a following generation. Let their name be blotted out." Now, all these cases on this page, I only have one more now, but all of them have to do with blotting out a name on the earth. Deuteronomy 12:3, "You shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars, burn their Asherim with fire, and you shall cut down the engraved images of their Elohim and obliterate their name from that place." Now, he's talking about specific Canaanite nations that have to be totally destroyed. There was only seven of them identified in Deuteronomy 7. It's kind of easy to remember. Deuteronomy 7, seven Canaanite nations. But there are certain selected peoples on the earth at that time who had gone so far beyond Yahweh's ordained order that the only solution was to kill everything, the animals and the idols and everything. I just remembered now, standing here, there's a promise. I think it's in the book of maybe Hosea, Amos. Maybe the elder can correct me if I got it wrong. But Yahweh says he will take the names of the Baals out of our mouth. You will no more remember them. Let's make sure I got this in order. Okay, let's talk about the bitter consequences of having a name blotted out. When we examine Bible passages where someone's name is removed from the book of life, it is really bad. It just looks bad. Now, there's a few here I have at the bottom. I'll draw your attention to the bottom of the panel in each case. Revelation 3:5, "He that overcometh, the same shall be clothed in white raiment, and I will not blot out his name out of the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels." Now, it looks like Yahshua has control of this book of life right now. But this is a promise. He won't blot your name out. Like, okay, good. I am looking ahead to that day, and I wonder how many people will be nervously watching to see if their names show up as he thumbs through the pages of the Book of Life. I went through a ritual twice a year when I studied Latin in high school, and I nervously opened the report card because I did very poorly in Latin. It's funny, now I love languages. I probably would have gobbled it up, but I did poorly in Latin class. There are other students who have gone to that same high school in Chicago, and if you bump into them and they took Latin from that same mean, cruel teacher, they will all say, yeah, that was rough. That was rough. He boxed us around. It was a Catholic school. It was a priest known for slapping people around. How do you learn in that environment? Well, I had this ritual where I opened the report card, and when I got a D, I knew, okay, I don't have to go to summer school. And often I would collapse on my bed, just exhausted from the tension of worrying about it. But that's how it's going to be on the judgment day. That book's going to open, and people are going to wonder, am I in there? Am I not? You know? Let's look at another verse at the bottom of the page here, Revelation 13:8. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, parentheses, that's the beast, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So it says the Lamb owns this book. He's got control of it. And being in the book of life is, well, that's the goal. You want to get in that book of life. You want to be in there. You want to be on the roll call. You want to be on the invitation list. Revelation 17:8. The beast that thou sawest was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. So, I don't have time to address the issue of predestination versus choice. I know this verse sounds like a predestination thing. I would just like you for now to focus on this emphasis of whether you're in that book or whether you're not. Now, the previous verses I read a while ago, they talked about your name being blotted out of the earth. And if you understand that, how serious that is in the economy of heaven, then it's becomes only natural that he has a book up there. I guess that's another thing we don't like about Christmas. Isn't it said that Santa Claus is making a list? He's checking it twice, you know. It puts him in the role of Yahshua, which I don't like. Let's see if there's more here. Yes, there's one more verse I had for you. It's from Philippians 4:3. The Philippians is one of Paul's audiences here in this letter. So when it shows up in the book of Revelation and in the letters written by Paul, that means that this is pretty much common knowledge, this book of life stuff. Philippians 4:3, and I entreat thee also, true yoke fellow, help those women which labored with me in the good news. Oh, that's funny. I just talked about that a few minutes ago. The women which labored with me in the good news. This feast for me was like a first feast. I'll never forget how much work everybody did here. Have you noticed how the grounds looked transformed in the last few weeks? Like, wang, it was a different place. See, when the men are out there running around doing all that, they're probably doing without the company of their husbands. Family life was disrupted. Well, anyway, pressing on. I entreat thee also, true yoke fellow, help those women which labored with me in the good news, with Clement also, and with other my fellow laborers whose names are in the book of life. Boy, what a great thing to be thought of. You're in the book of life. You dodge that cannonball. You're there for good. Just behave yourself, okay? Exodus 23:31. Commences an interesting passage showing that this book existed long before the New Covenant era. Exodus 32:31-33. You'll remember the context when I read it. And Moses returned unto Yahweh and said, Oh, this people have sinned a great sin and have made them Elohim of gold. Yet now if thou wilt forgive their sin, and if not blot me, I pray thee, out of thy book which thou hast written, then boom, Yahweh interrupts him. If you look carefully at that sentence, it's like dangling, it's like hanging. Yahweh interrupts it. And Yahweh said unto Moses, Whosoever hath sinned against me, him will I blot out of my book. In other words, he's telling Moses, you can't make this trade. You can't make this deal. Now, Paul kind of alludes to this idea in his writings. He said, I wish that I could be accursed so that all of Israel could be saved. He would love to do a deal like that. You'll find that Moses and Yahshua had a number of things in common. One is they were both humble, but they also had a love for sinners. It looks like Paul is in the mix there too, willing to sacrifice his own life for all of Israel. Yahweh stops him here and says, no, I blot out the names of those who sin against me. So this book was common knowledge even in ancient times. We're going to look at specific cases of people whose names were blotted out. Either they're blotted out or they're going to be blotted out. Amalek is an interesting one. I notice how the Amalekites are often referred to simply by the name of their father. In Exodus 17, 14 through 16, we're going to look quite a bit at Amalek just because it's an interesting case. And Yahweh said unto Moses, Write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Yahweh Nisi. That's where we get the expression Yahweh Nisi. For Yahweh is my banner. For he said, Because Yahweh hath sworn that Yahweh will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. What did Amalek do that was so bad? Here's another verse mentioning Amalek. Numbers 24, verse 20. And when he looked on Amalek, he took up his parable and said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his latter end shall be that he perish forever. Now, Amalek was certainly not the first nation, nor it was a premier nation. Other countries like Egypt might be considered premier. So what does he mean when he say Amalek was the first of the nations? Well, first let's find out where Amalek come from to make sure. It's in Genesis 36, 12. It says, And Timnah was concubine to Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bare to Eliphaz Amalek. These were the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. So down at the bottom of the screen, I give you a little mini genealogy. Esau and Adah had a child named Eliphaz. Eliphaz had a concubine named Timnah, and they gave birth to Amalek. So Amalek is the grandson of Esau. In fact, he would be the great-grandson of Isaac and the great-great-grandson of Abraham. So in a sense, these are Hebrews, these Amalekites. So what does they mean, first of nations? Amalek was simply the first nation to come against the new nation of Israel. Think about it. They're just coming out of Egypt. The Amalekites attack from the rear. And they were particularly evil about it. We get more details of the story in Deuteronomy 25, starting at verse 17. Remember what Amalek did unto thee by the way, when you were come forth out of Egypt. How he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not Elohim. Therefore it shall be, when Yahweh the Elohim hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about, in the land which Yahweh the Elohim giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under the heaven, thou shalt not forget it. So some of the people were lagging behind there, and Amalek used that as an opening to like attack. Hundreds of years later, in the book of 1 Samuel, Yahweh remembers. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. Let's review what we know about Amalek. Amalek was the first to start war against Israel. Amalek zoomed in on the slower, weaker members of the migrating Israelites. This was roughly equivalent to dropping bombs on hospitals and infirmaries. Hey, I dropped bombs on hospitals and senior homes, you know. Yahweh will always make war with Amalek. Ultimately, their remembrance will be blotted out. Now, we're talking about on the earth. So any one individual Amalekite can enter eternal life if they enter covenant with Yahweh. This was always allowed under similar cases. Some historical notes might prove interesting. Jewish scribes warm up their ink pens by what they do is they dip their pen in ink first thing in the morning. They write the name Amalek, and then they draw a line through it. That's how they get their pens warmed up. So I kind of showed that with the slides here. I don't know if you can see the line through the name Amalek, but that's what they do. Also, in Jewish tradition, they have certain things they're supposed to remember frequently, and one of them is the fact that Israel will always be at war with Amalek for the cruel and evil thing they do. Though he is remembered today, the name of Amalek will be blotted out. It does seem kind of odd. Just suppose I tell you, stop thinking about the color red. Suppose I said to you right now, okay, y'all, stop thinking about the color red. Now raise your hand when you stop thinking about the color red. And you can't do it because if you raise your hand, well, you're thinking, well, why am I raising my hand? And then the color red's going to come back. So this sounds like almost like a riddle or a conundrum. How can you remember to blot out somebody's name? And there are times it has nearly driven me wild wrapping my head around this. But there must be some spiritual lesson here that what he did was so foul, so bottom rung evil, so sinister that getting his name blotted out is like some kind of a high priority quest. Let's stop and think what somebody has to do to get their name blotted out by divine ordinance. Sometimes people's names will be blotted out because they never managed to raise up a firstborn son, or they died before they could, and there was no one to raise up a child with the wife. Maybe people's names are blotted out because they just happen to get gobbled up in a war zone. What does somebody have to do to cross a line where Yahweh says, that's it, I don't want any record of this person or this group of people anymore? Every one of us should be asking ourselves, is it possible to cross a line with Yahweh where you go too far? Is that possible? So let me talk, it's not in the slides, but let me speak to this a little bit. It's an analogy. It's not perfect. But as you drive towards Chicago, if you're looking in the right direction on a clear day, sooner or later you'll see that giant tall building from Chicago. It's formerly known as the Sears Tower, used to be the tallest building in the world. Now it's called Willis Tower. We still call it Sears Tower. But you can see it. And if you start from Chicago and go away, and you frequently look back, you can see the building. And you know if you're lost and you want to get back to Chicago, all you have to do is look for that tall building on the skyline. You say, oh, there it is. I see it. I can make my way back. And the farther you travel from the Chicago, the harder it is to see that tall building. Well, it is possible to go so far away that you can't see the building anymore. And if it's a cloudy day and you cannot discern the directions, you're lost. You'll never make your way back. If that's how you're navigating. And that's what it is like with Yahweh. It is possible to drift so far from him, you can't make your way back. It's not that he's gone anywhere. He's still there, and he's willing to welcome you. He's willing to welcome you back into good graces. I once had a fellow explain it to me like this. He was he was addicted to alcohol, and he said, "I know Yahweh can forgive any sin. His mercy is infinite. He's always there." But he says, "When I'm in sin, I don't think that way. When I'm in sin, I don't see his mercy. It's like in the distance. I can't find him." And that's really what happens. Yahweh doesn't go anywhere. What happens is people do these wicked things. They cross a line, and they have a hard time reconstructing a pathway back. This business of having our names blotted out looks real serious. And you should be asking yourself, am I on the threshold of doing something that's going to push me beyond that line? Here's a second case, Pharaoh. Now let's establish the fact that Yahweh can give us the name of the Pharaoh. Okay, it's in 1 Kings 14:25. I'm just referencing it to show that Yahweh is very willing to give us the name of the king of Egypt. And it came to pass in the fifth year of King Rehoboam that Shishak, king of Egypt, came against Jerusalem. Now, Rehoboam was the son of Solomon, the one who inherited the throne from Solomon. Here's a tip. There is two competing princes for the throne after Solomon. Jeroboam broke away and started northern Israel. Rehoboam continued with southern Judah. An easy way to remember is that the letter R and the letter S are next to each other in the alphabet. Rehoboam was the son of Solomon and continued with the southern kingdom there. Okay, so that's how you remember. But Yahweh's willing to give us the name of an Egyptian king. Yet in the Exodus story, the name of the Pharaoh is withheld. Why? You know, there's scholars who have banged their heads against the wall trying to figure out who the Pharaoh of Exodus is. For now, I tend to lean toward a king named Dudemozi. In Emmanuel Velikovsky's research, he found a writing describing a pharaoh who was lost in a whirlpool, and his name was called Dudemozi. And it was right around the time of the Exodus, when you have the timing proper. It says something like, "He was not, for he was lost in the whirlpool," something like that. Why didn't the Elohim breathe by his spirit the name of that Pharaoh into the story? Well, the answer is simple. Pharaoh is a type of Satan, isn't he? Let's do a profile on Pharaoh. Pharaoh oppressed Yah's people. Sounds like Satan to me. He was an idolater. He and his people thought he was a deity. That sounds like Satan, doesn't it? He was stubborn, unrepentant, and high-minded. When you think about it, the comparisons between Pharaoh and Satan are striking. Pharaoh is a type of Satan. Sounds like a good reason to me to get his name blotted out. It's just removed from the record. Totally expunged. Unlike Amalek, his name is expunged right from the word go. It isn't like, oh, here's his name, you're not going to use it anymore. No, it's just not there. It's like a third case, the derelict kinsman redeemer. This one means a lot to me. Now remember, I got four sisters and a mom. And there was no daddy in our house, excuse me. So there's a certain sense of oversight, love, and protection I have for my younger sisters. And boy, was I relieved when my sisters were all married off. I was so relieved. In Yahweh's economy, performing the duties of kinsman redeemer is serious business. It is even more critical in the case of a levirate marriage. That's a deal where a husband dies, leaves a wife unprotected. And protecting of the women is really important in Yahweh's eyes. And We are a spiritually enlightened people. There's a lot of things to protect women from these days. Thank you so much for that water. Wow, I really appreciate that. Thanks a lot. But when a widow is floating around out there without a husband to protect her, again, in Yahweh's economy, that's sad. That's tragic. I heard a brother once say that the women make the home. In the Hebrew culture, the women make the home, the men protect the home. Now, when a man refuses to raise up a generation for his kinsmen, he takes this widow and raises up a child through her for his brother's name. Let's look at what the law says, and you get a taste for how important this is. In Deuteronomy 25, 9 to 10, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders. Now, this is the guy who refuses to take this woman, make her his wife, and, of course, fulfill this duty of raising up a child. His brother's wife should come unto him in the presence of the elders. This is out in the open. These are your official witnesses. And loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face and shall answer and say, so shall it be done unto the man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, quote, the house of him that hath his shoe loosed. A spit in the guy's face right in front of everybody. So I'm going to interpret what you just heard. Here is what happens to the man who refuses to raise up a generation for his kinsmen. His shoe is removed, indicating he will never walk on the land of his dead brother. You wondered what that shoe was about? That's the explanation. She's saying, this shoe I just took from you will never walk on your brother's land. The widow spits in his face, open rejection and humiliation. By the way, this knucklehead just blotted out his brother's name. By this decision, he blotted out his brother's name. And so his own name becomes a byword, a put down. Let's go back. The house of him that hath his shoe loosed. It's like everybody's going to know. What? You wouldn't take that widow under your protection? That was your brother's wife. You wouldn't raise up a child, you know, for that family? You're a bum. And everybody's going to know. So now we look at Ruth. Look at this. This is the background of Ruth. You'll find in the Bible sometimes the law says one thing and people do something kind of similar. Okay. In the book of Ruth, a particular kinsman redeemer refuses to take in Ruth. A lot of people enjoy reading the book of Ruth, and we might come away thinking, yeah, Ruth and Boaz, that's a marriage made in heaven. That was Yahweh's will. Well, it wasn't. That was Yahweh's plan B. Yahweh's perfect will is that a kinsman redeemer closer in line, first in line, should have taken Ruth. That was Yahweh's perfect will. Marrying Boaz was plan B. And I must say, the story still puts a lump in my throat. I don't know about you. But here's what happens when you read the story of Ruth. Boaz tells this guy in front of the elders, says, you know, you got to marry her. You got to redeem her land and everything. And the guy says, well, I like the idea. I'm kind of summarizing. He says, I like the idea of taking all that land, but if I marry her, it's going to mess up my inheritance. I don't know what the deal is. Maybe his wife was jealous. I don't know. But so he decides, I'm not going to do it. I'm just not going to do it. And so Boaz says, well, I'm next in line. I'll do it. So this fellow has his shoe removed. It doesn't have Ruth doing it, but his shoe is removed, indicating he will never walk on the land of his dead brother. No one spits in his face, but this kinsman redeemer's name is never recorded. His name is blotted out. You don't know who this guy is. Case number four, the devil himself. I want you to know, I checked with the elders on this before bringing this forth. All three of our local elders understood They either heard about this or they understood this. Observant Bible scholars have pointed out that we do not know the name of the evil one. And if you ask people who don't know better, they'll say, well, isn't that Satan? You know? And really, Satan is more accurately Hashatan, the enemy, in the scriptures. Interestingly, in the Aramaic, it's Satana. And that A at the end means the same as Ha. Excuse me. It means Satana in Aramaic is the same as Ha-Satan in Hebrew. Devil just means evil one. You take the D out of devil and you got evil. The evil one. Okay? Chicago slang. Yeah. The Cubs, the Bulls, the Bears, the Blackhawks, the devil. Okay. But really, that's what I mean. It's just a descriptor. It's impossible that he had been given this name at his creation. Do you think the Almighty made him and said, okay, you're the devil? No, that's not what happened. He's called Lucifer in, I think, Ezekiel. But that's actually from the Hebrew word Halel. It means morning star. He is also called son of the morning in that passage in the Hebrew. Together, these sound more like the scriptures. Let's tap the break here and talk about some very special brethren in history. I call them pre-messianic brethren. These are faithful Jews who lived before Yahshua's time. These brethren were in Alexandria, Egypt. We know they loved Yahweh's name because when they made the Septuagint, the Greek Septuagint translation, they put Yahweh's name in the original ancient Hebrew letters. They handled his name with care and love. They didn't blot it out. They didn't translate it, smudge it out. So one historical report says that they used gold paint to make his name in those ancient Hebrew letters. They love Yah's name. These are our pre-messianic brethren. Now, some of you might be concerned about the curse in Jeremiah 44. Certain Jews, at the time of the Babylonian invasion, certain Jews had said, we're not going to put up with this. We're going to run to Egypt for safety. And it appears that they had ran to an island called Elephantine on the Nile River. There was a big colony of Jews there. They had a little temple to Yahweh there. But interestingly, in Jeremiah's time, they had a real problem with Queen of Heaven worship. And would you believe it? Historical records show that the Jews at Elephantine, those rascals, they worshiped Yahweh and the Queen of Heaven both together. So it looks like there's a historical connection there. We ultimately don't know what happened to the Jews at Elephantine, but Yahweh says in Jeremiah 44 that they would all be hunted down and killed except for a few, and the few that remain would never remember his name. Now think about that. I should have worked that in. But if you forget Yahweh's name, that's like a punishment. Yahweh's angry at you. The Jews I'm talking about lived in Alexandria, much farther north, and they loved Yahweh's name. Now, when they created the Greek Septuagint, they did not treat the word Halel, that word that's made Lucifer in the Latin. They did not treat that as a name. They treated it as a description or a title. If it was a name, they would have transliterated it, just like they do all names. Names are always transliterated. When you take words like Lucifer, Halel, Morning Star, Son of the Morning, words like that, these are looking, in aggregate, they look more like descriptors. Lucifer was not transliterated into the Greek Septuagint, so the ancients did not regard it as a name. It was translated to words indicating light or dawn in the Greek. It is inescapable. We do not know the name of the evil one. I would just pause and think about that. For a lot of people who hear this for the first time, it's like a surprise. Like, wait a minute. How did this escape my notice? Look, when Yahshua is talking to him in the desert, I think he uses the word Satan, but he's just saying enemy. You know, just calling him an enemy. And there is you got to have a legitimate word in your Hebrew to say enemy, you know. One thing I don't like is when people who don't know better, I'm sure they mean well, but there was a time when Peter was correcting Yahshua. Yahshua said, they're going to kill me. They're going to murder me. Peter said, oh, no, not with you. Oh, no, they're not going to do that. And Yahshua turned to him and said, get behind me, Satan, for you savor the things of men and not the things of Elohim. When he called him Satan, Christians who don't know better think he's saying Peter is the devil or has a devil in him. No, what he's saying is, get behind me, enemy. Now, he's using a strong word, but he's calling Peter an enemy. If we can get out of our mind, jettison from our mind the false assumption that the word Satan is a name, we're able to step back and drink in what's really going on here. The enemy of our souls was once an exalted cherub. He had a very exclusive, privileged position in Yahweh's intergalactic kingdom. And he did something so evil, so foul. The other night I was discussing this with Sister Lisa. I wish I could recreate her choice of words. Very articulate, passionate, kind of insight. We don't know the specifics. But for this joker to lure a third of the angels with him, to have his name blotted out, he must have done something really, really bad. He must have really broken trust, crossed a line. He went somewhere he should not have gone, and he knew it. We just don't know his name, and that should be a tip-off to something. Observant Bible students have pointed out that we do not know the name of the evil one. Using other cases as a guide, it is evident that the Satan did something really bad in the past to have his name blotted out. Let me do a summary of cases where people's names are blotted out. Those who are eternally condemned. Book of Revelation talks about this. Pharaoh, name blotted out. The derelict kinsman redeemer. By the way, observant Bible students would tell you that Boaz, the guy who did the job, he was a type of Messiah. It gets back to some of that prophecy stuff we were talking about, dramatic prophecy, where the lives of the ancient ones actually tell a story looking ahead. Then there was Amalek, picking on the weak. Then there's Hashatan, the enemy of our souls. On the whole, this is the biggest bunch of losers you'll ever find. Right? It just doesn't get any worse than this cast of characters. Their names are blotted out. I'm going to ask you now to let me pose a question. We are thundering to the finish line here. So we are completing early. Throughout the original scriptures, foreign names are transliterated and very rarely translated. I'm talking about in your Hebrew and even in the Greek. Names are pulled in, names of worthless pagan deities and pagan kings. And Yahweh has ordained that this be so. In some cases, we don't even know what the meaning is for the names of pagan kings and pagan deities, but we know what they sound like. If I had time, I can find two scholars, I got it on my hard drive, independent scholars, who are just amazed at how faithful the Hebrew scriptures are with importing foreign names. That's Yahweh's style. You transliterate names. Yet when we come to ordinary translations of the Bible, ordinary English translation of the Bible, we find Yahweh's name everywhere missing. We got this word, Lord, looking back at us. It's not even a translation of his name. There was a translation that came out about 100 years ago called the Moffat translation, and he rendered Yahweh's name as the eternal. You know, at least he's trying. At least he's trying to render the idea behind Yahweh's name. His name means he is or he will be. But this L-O-R-D stuff, it's not even close. Question, how in the world did we wind up in a situation where Yahweh's name is blotted out as though he were a criminal, a reprobate derelict? How did this happen? It's all flipped around. He's telling Moses, my name is going to be honored through this series of events you're about to experience. And we turn around, here we are, thousands of years later, And nobody knows his name. It's common. People are knowing about Yahweh's name more and more, especially in the world of religion. But it's equally common to find people say, I didn't know the Almighty had a name. How did this happen? And that's where I was going with this. There are doctrinal features of the sacred name fellowship which may seem odd at first. We use his true name freely in worship. It's rarely done outside of this network. We do have people who are informed, and they'll put his name in there kind of like a throw-in. Like, we'll throw that, like you're putting salt on a dish of food to make it taste a little better. For them, it's a throw-in. But it's not a central area of worship. We use his true name freely in worship, and we avoid names of blasphemy. Let me take a side note here. I'm trying to give you a basis for embracing the style of worship we restore here. If you want to know wisdom from the perspective of Yahweh, you turn to the book of Proverbs. That's what it's for. If you want to know the history of early mankind and where the Israelites came from, you look to Genesis. Every book of the Bible has like a main thing to tell you. Like if you want to know where David came from, you look at the book of Ruth. You see his genealogy in there. Every book has its own thing it's good for. If you want to know the history of the early messianic movement, you look at the book of Acts. If you want to know about Yahshua's life, you look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You want to know about his teachings, and you look at those same books. All these books have their emphases, their hot points. If you want to know how to worship Yahweh, you look at the book of Psalms. It's really not hard to lock in on that. Oh, I want to know how to worship him. I'll look at the book that's full of instructions on how to worship. And what do you have? Page after page after page. Honor his name. Glorify his name. Praise his name. The other nations, they have idols. That's what they worship. We're told to worship. It sounds crazy, but we're told to praise his name, honor his name. It sounds like we're worshiping his name. But that's all he gave us. It's not an image on the wall. It's not some fancy carved thing that we picked up on eBay and stuck in the corner of our church. No, it's his name. That's what he wants us to honor. And of course, when we think on his name, of course, it does mean he's eternal. He exists. He's not made up. He's not the work of men's hands. And boy, he looks at a lot of things differently than you and me. And he requires us to think like him. We use his true name and we avoid names of blasphemy. The Psalms instruct us in this. Here's what happens if we fall short of the beauty of holiness in which we are obliged to worship. We fall short of that, we wind up in this realm where we're not using his name. We're using made-up stuff. Some of these names are not allowed. The enemy and members of his kingdom are delighted to receive worship under false names. Now here's two passages. You have to put them together to get the composite. In 1 Corinthians 10:20, it says, but I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils and not to Yahweh. And I would not that you would have fellowship with devils. Psalm 16, verse 4, their sorrow shall be multiplied that hasten after another Elohim. Their drink offerings of blood will I not offer, nor take up their names into my lips. Now, there's a whole lot more I could give you. Big sermon, long sermons about embracing Yahweh's name, avoiding false names. But these two verses should be enough. I'm going to summarize my remarks today and give you something to run with. Names are important in the Bible. Names enjoy transliteration and care in handling throughout the original scriptures. It is verifiably bad to have someone's name blotted out. Those whose names are blotted out comprise the worst representatives of all that's evil in the scriptures. Oddly, the Almighty's name is blotted out of Jewish tradition and in most common Bibles. There is something wrong with this picture. Satan has his own name blotted out. He arranges for Yah's name to be blotted out, and his demons receive worship when worship is done in wrong names. As you leave the feast this weekend, go in peace, go in shalom. knowing that this great cosmic trick is exactly what we are standing against, and that the restoration of pure worship is our quest. Pure words, calves of our lips, the fruit of our lips. Two psalms mention the beauty of holiness. That's what we're striving for here. Psalm 29, verse 2. Ascribe unto Yahweh the glory due unto his name. Worship Yahweh in the beauty of holiness. There are times when we might approach the band. There hasn't been a whole lot of this lately because they work real hard to keep it tight. But there are times people come to the band and say, you know, there's a line there in that song that's not scripturally sound. And that's because sometimes we import songs from other places. The beauty of holiness, we really want that clean. No comparison's perfect, but you know, guys, girls, let's say you think back to a courtship situation, you quote, put your best foot forward, maybe because you want that relationship to work out so well. When we approach Yahweh, he has standards, and we have every responsibility to make sure we put our best foot forward, and it's out of love, it's for propriety, and that's what he wants. I guess I should also say when we approach him, yes, he wants us to relate to him, to rejoice in him. But to tell you the truth, we got to do this stuff because we need him. It's like we got to show up because we need him. Psalm 96, verse 9, oh, worship Yahweh in the beauty of holiness. Fear before him all the earth. Well, that concludes my remarks. Brother Javon, you can take it from here. Thanks so much for hearing me through on this, then mighty shalom.